Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today, $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. Message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.
Good evening, and welcome to Booker T. Washington Speaks, African American Family Room Forum. We're certainly happy that you've chosen to join us tonight, and we are certainly hoping that you will participate in our program. We thank those of you who have tuned in. We look forward to having a delightful conversation. We want to welcome our regular panelists, Mr. Pianchi, who has arrived, and we're looking forward for the arrival of others. But in the meantime, I just want to do a check to make sure that we are going out. So, Ms. Pianchi, all right, I've given the mic over to you, and I just want to check. Are we going out? Can you hear us?
Yeah, we can hear you very well. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, sir. Just doing very well. Let me go ahead and take just a moment and introduce the topic for tonight. Our topic for tonight is, why did Howard University Medical School terminate the employment of Assistant Professor Dr. Frances Press Wesleyan after she published her racial theories of white self-alienation and color confrontation? And let me just mention this. I want to give a little brief summary. After, first of all, Dr. Wesleyan came from a prominent family of physicians, but she became a nationally known figure after she published her controversial book, The ISIS Papers, in 1991, which expanded upon an essay that she wrote in the 1970s while she was working at Howard University. Dr. Francis Cress Wesley was born March the 18th, 1935, to Dr. Henry Cress, a medical doctor, and Ida Griffin, a school teacher in Chicago. And she attended Antioch College, and she graduated in 1957 with her bachelor's degree, and then went on to attend medical school at Howard University, graduating in 1962 with her MD degree, the Washington, D.C. area, because she did a three-year residency after getting her MD. She did a three-year residency in psychiatry and became a licensed medical psychiatrist. And so then she worked there as a resident, and after that was hired by Howard University as an assistant professor of pediatrics, and her specialty was pediatric psychiatry. But during that time, she published her essay, The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism, in parentheses, White Supremacy, which left some divided over her theories surrounding white supremacy and her theory of an insidious scheme by white supremacists to hold black people as inferior. According to her own account, Howard University decided not to give her tenure after working there for 7 years, not to renew her position by giving her tenure with the school after this paper came out, the paper I just mentioned. And again, the title was The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism or White Supremacy. You know, during that time frame, she achieved a minor amount of fame in 1974 by participating in, I would say, a debate. It's not technically a debate, but it was a actual dialogue with William Shockley of Stanford University on the Tony Brown Journal show, with Tony Brown moderating the discussion. And she was able to present her work of the theory from her paper to a national audience at that time. But shortly after that, she was up for review for tenure. And the Committee at Howard on Tenure and Promotions recommended her for tenure. But the dean, a Dr. Mann, I think his name was Marble Mann, but Dr. Mann denied her. He had the authority, in spite of the recommendation of the committee, to unilaterally deny her tenure. And the president at that time was Dr. James Cheek, who supported Dr. Mann in denying Dr. Francis Cress Wesley a position, permanent position. So then she began working with the Department of Human Services and worked over two decades as a psychiatrist, mostly with children, and she was acclaimed for her work. I just want to add this last part. Despite the, and this is from the BlackAmerica.web website, a little known black history fact concerning Dr. Francis Cress Wesley. But despite the accolades given online by figures such as Public Enemies, Chuck D, and others, Wesley's views were seen as homophobic and even misogynist by some measures. And then the ISIS papers, which as I mentioned were published in 1991, expanded on several of Dr. Wesley's ideas about whites being threatened, the scope of black people around the world. And just one other point, and then I'll be finished with that introduction. The key or the essence of her theory, of course, she said she passed a couple of years ago, unfortunately, She was 80 years old. But the key to her theory was the concept of white, the fear of white people of genetic annihilation. And she said that was the reason for white supremacist attitudes and all of the horrific things that white people have done throughout, not just American history, but even prior to American history, to either exterminate or repress the colored people of the world. So that's basically some information about her. But the key to the discussion tonight is not so much what she did in her later life, because she was acclaimed on many fronts. She never was rehired by Howard. Unfortunately, they never gave her the recognition that many people gave her. But the point is that during that time, 1975 was the height of the black separatists and the black nationalists and the black power movement. And if one were to gain access to the FBI counterintelligence program papers, which are available, there's a lot of redaction done, but they are available for the asking. You just have to apply. And some of those papers, I understand, you actually have to go to their headquarters and under supervision make copies of the papers there. But some of these are available online. And the fact is that it's known that they did have a very overt, not covert, but overt program to stamp out black racism, what they call reverse racism, black separatism, and organizations and even individuals that were promoting the kinds of ideas that Dr. Francis Cress Wilson was promoting. So the question is, why did Howard University Medical School terminate her employment, in other words, deny her tenure, so she could remain on the faculty there? So I don't know if I need to cover that anymore. I think I've probably covered enough on that. We were waiting. One reason why I took a few extra minutes, Mr. Pack, is we were waiting for others to join us. I had invited in particular two people, both PhDs, one a PhD in education, the other a PhD in African-American studies and economics. And I was waiting to see if they were going to be able to come on to participate. But we'll definitely be able to get this started. So what do you think? Why do you think Howard University denied tenure to Dr. Francis Cress Wilson?
Well, what she wrote was considered as being highly inflamed, biased, and probably racist. You know, see, when you use that word, when you generalize, when you generalize a people,
you know, see, when you use that word,
and you got feedback, man.
You know, I'm going to go ahead and somebody else just joined us, and I'll be bringing him on in just a few minutes. But I don't know if feedback was coming from that end, but that was the only other caller. Since you started talking, so I put that person phone.
Yeah, let me
on
see
you.
What did. Yeah, that's better. No, but when
okay.
You generalize people like that, then it becomes offensive. It's basically like saying all blacks are the same. So, if it had been identifying a specific group or element, maybe it would have went over good. But Howard has done that to others too. I think it done it to Chancellor Williams also. And maybe George G.M. James, I'm not sure. But let's see what somebody else has to say.
Okay, well, before I bring on our other caller, who I definitely look forward to hearing, and I just want to mention that around that same time, a professor of sociology, I believe it was sociology that was his field, he was in the Nation of Islam in San Francisco. But he was actually a tenure track professor at Stanford University, which is the home campus of Dr. Shockley, and his name was Dr. Cedric X. I can't remember his last name. It may come to me. I was trying to find if he was still around, if there was some information about him and the debate that he had at Stanford with Dr. Shockley, but I hadn't seen anything yet. But when he came up for tenure after that debate, he was denied tenure by Stanford around that same time frame. And, of course, I don't know what kind of influence Dr. Shockley himself may have had in Dr. Francis Chris Welsing's being denied, but I would have reason to believe that he may have had some influence in Dr. Cedric's being denied tenure, even if he didn't speak to anybody about that he didn't feel that Dr. Cedric was appropriate to be on that faculty permanently. And I don't even know if he would have done that. But I do know that the fact that Dr. Cedric stood up to Dr. Shockley's what I consider to be very uninformed racist ideas about black IQ inferiority, that the fact that Dr. Shockley was confronted by Dr. Cedric might have caused Dr. Cedric not to have been employed permanently at Stanford. So you're absolutely right. Well, I'm going to ask our caller just joined us for me to repeat the topic. We want to welcome our caller from Detroit. We are certainly glad you've joined us tonight. And you can introduce yourself if you would like, or if you want me to, I'll be glad to do it. But I always like for our callers to have the freedom not to announce themselves if they don't care to do it. So that's your choice. We want to welcome you and also want to ask you, would you like for me to repeat tonight's topic? So I call from Detroit. Welcome, and please go ahead, sir.
Hey, how you doing today, my good friend? It's a pleasure to be on your show. Absolutely. I hope you got warmer weather down where you're at.
Had a beautiful
day
today.
This is Dr. Ken Harris, President and CEO of the National Business League. It's an honor to be on the call with the eldest living male descendant of Booker T. Washington and having a discussion on the prolific, you know, Francis Luella Welsing, you know. And so, you know, this is a great topic to have, especially, I think, in the essence of what's going on today with HBCUs.
Well, fantastic. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Harris, for joining us tonight. And you're right. There's so much going on, not only, as you mentioned, with HBCUs, but there's also a lot of, I don't know if I am appropriately using the word drama, but there's also a lot of drama going on within the what are commonly called PWIs, the predominantly white institutions, concerning tenure track African American professors, and I don't know how that's going to play out, but I just want to mention a really quick anecdote about my own university. I fortunately was able to get appointed to an adjunct history professor, a position while I'm finishing up my doctorate. And hopefully once I have completed, I may be invited to become a tenure track professor. But at least I do have a paid job teaching there. And the way I was able to get that job was because two successive African-American tenure track professors quit abruptly. At first, I thought it had something to do with Carpenter, who I didn't know that well, but when I got hired by him and we became more acquainted with each other, I realized that, at least from my perspective, he couldn't have been the cause of them leaving, because he's been totally supportive of myself in the position of being an instructor out there in the department. But something's going on. And I know for a fact that there are only a few black professors in the faculties of most of these PWIs. There's only one right now in our department, that's myself. And there's always been only one, and I've been on the campus for 15 years. I'm not saying that's by design either. But the fact of the matter is that I've looked around the landscape of black academia, and it seems to be that a lot of these formerly stabilized professors are taking early retirement or they're leaving. The young people that are in the age group where you are actually are finding it more and more difficult to succeed through the tenure track. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the same reason why Dr. Francis Chris Wesley was not rehired, because there's a lot of fear that the outspoken black national science professors may cause problems for the administration. And I know for a fact that I'm walking a tightrope. I have to be, nobody had to tell me this. I know I have to be very prudent and careful about what I put in my syllabus in terms of what black people have endured at the hands of white people in America. I teach U.S. history, and I teach the period from the diaspora through the Reconstruction, some of the most horrific things that have happened to a people happened during that period. And I have to be careful how I approach it, because I could approach it from the Nation of Islam point of view, or even from Dr. Francis Chris Wesley's point of view, and I probably won't get rehired. Nobody has to tell me that. I can feel that. What do you? I want to get back to Ms. Bianchi in a second, but Dr. Hesh, what do you think about all that I just said?
Oh, no, I just think it's reminiscent of, you know, the words of Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who prophetically always spoke in the tradition of the miseducation and indoctrination of, one, our scholars who happen to matriculate to predominantly white institutions, and also the culture of academia in historically black colleges and universities due to, obviously, the founding mechanisms of a lot of these institutions who are already indoctrinated a culture that exhibited of the ways of some of these predominantly white institutions, if we be honest with ourselves. And so I think you can actually link this to commentary. If you heard recently, a scholar that was out there was an actual advocate for CNN, Mark Lamont Hill, who was cut from CNN, but was also a professor at Temple University. And he came under fire for his comments about Palestine and Israel during his speech at the UN. And so immediately, because of his comments, not only was he fired from CNN, but they went after him at the University of Temple. And there was a lot of, as you know, he's a tenured professor there. But as an African-American, it's funny how when you speak out on issues and you're supposed to have the freedom of expression and in your own scholarly work and attainment, that Dr. Lamont Hill came up under question. And so that tells you to the scrutiny of black folks both trying to operate and facilitate their academic pursuits and scholarly pursuits at these universities, we still got a lot of work to do.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you so much. Stay with us. I want to go back to Mr. Bianchi. Mr. Bianchi is a regular panelist. He's been with the show since its inception 2 years ago. In fact, it's 2 years ago this month, and almost from day one, he's been a member of our regular panel. And so I want to give him an opportunity to respond to what you just said. What are your thoughts, Ms. Bianchi?
Well, I don't know much about the guy that was person that was let go with CNN. But I'm sure the CNN probably had a long list of subjects that when you go to comment on, you have to comment on them in a certain way. You know, it goes back to the old thumb rule that businesses control media. And if you don't have the businesses that's commanding the ad dollars, then media will do all sorts of things. And as I said before, Howard University, any university, is critical on what is said by its professor. You know, getting back to CNN, when Donald Trump complained about CNN, everybody calls him a fool. So here CNN apparently has gotten rid of some reporter, or shall I say a host, for what they said. But no, Howard University, like any other university, is considering its endowment and where it comes from. And we have known before that the universities have curtailed the speech, not only on the public scene, but also in the classroom, what some individuals teach. So it's something you're going to have to live with or effectively change, one of the two.
Well, I think you have very succinctly and, in my opinion, accurately defined the essence and defined the reason why Howard let Dr. Frances Chris Wesley go. She had distinguished herself. As I mentioned, she had actually done a residency, I believe it was there, but it may have been elsewhere in the area, but in any event, she had established herself well enough in her residency to be invited to become a tenure track professor at Howard. And it wasn't until this particular paper came out, and maybe the publicity, which it didn't appear on YouTube at the time because there was no YouTube then, but I'm sure the word got around that she went out and had this debate on, well, actually it was on Tony Brown Journal, so it would have been publicized. But even though her work spoke very well of her character as a professional and as a teacher and as a doctor, because the Committee on Promotions and Tenure did recommend her to be retained as a tenured associate professor. But at the, what I would say, business level or level of authority where real decisions are made at the dean's level and the president's level, probably for the reasons you stated, being afraid of a loss of endowment funds, she was not allowed to stay there. And going back to what Dr. Harris just said, and I'll turn it back over to you, Dr. Harris, the problem is that even on the historically black college campuses, you still have that real, what I would say, chain around, or whatever you want to call it, muzzle around the mouths of the professors. I remember very well when the Civil Rights Movement was in full bloom back in the 60s, and I was at Tuskegee. Some very prominent and erudite young professors were basically muzzled just for promoting voting rights, and some of them didn't stay at Tuskegee very long because the people that actually endowed Tuskegee, the Board of Trustees, members, a predominantly white group of rich businessmen, backed up by some of the southern, what I call planter class people around Alabama, did not want that kind of voice to be heard. And Dr. Harris, you can address this, but I feel that even today in 2018, almost 2019, over 50-some years later, that the professors still have to be cautious. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what do you think?
Oh, no, I agree 100%. And I think our other caller hit it right on the nail. You know, he who holds the cash rules, right? And so when you look at endowment dollars, when you look at major contributors to HBCUs and universities, especially predominantly white institutions, you have to pay attention to that. And, you know, as an example of, you know, just based on 2016 statistics, Howard University, which is a predominantly historically black college institution in D.C., you know, basically has a 58% black faculty. And when you think about the promises that have been made, obviously with the downtrend of black PhDs entering into tenure track positions, those promises have gone unfilled. In the fact that we know both in predominantly white institutions and HBCUs, there's a higher graduation rate of people receiving their doctor of philosophy and going on to graduate, defend their dissertation and publish their works. And so if we know that there's increase in graduation rates of PhDs, but there is a decrease in faculty in both HBCUs and at predominantly white institutions, is a major discussion that needs to be had. It has a lot to do with the culture. It has a lot to do with the obviously in the near future, there's going to be, from what I'm hearing, between now and 2020, a large retirement class that is going to be leaving their tenure track positions and retiring, which is going to leave a huge void amongst our academic ranks. And then when you also see, I mean, just the statistics are extremely startling in the fact that when you have low representation, and statistically speaking, black PhDs and black faculty nationwide represent about 1.7% of the entire academic population. And so when you think about those statistics, there's not much of a voice either. So in this whole conversation of something else that I think that we're missing is this conversation on diversity. I classify it as a diversity distraction or a diversity delusion, because at the end of the day, in terms of diversity and inclusion, it has not included black folks, although it was built off of the backs of black folks. And so everyone else from Asian, Hispanic, gay to lesbian, or LGBT, women, white women in particular, have benefited in faculty tenure positions more so than black folks have. And so, there's a lot of contributing factors, I believe, as to why we have to reengage this discussion. And where are the outside advocacy organizations or institutions that's truly trying to make sure that as black PhDs continue to trend up, that the hiring is equal and representative of that as well?
Well, thank you. We really appreciate that, and we want you to stay with us for a little bit longer. We're going to stop at 9 o'clock. But I do want to give you the floor to, if you would like to address the program of the National Business League and how you may perceive, or how you do perceive, the National Business League being able to be a vehicle to help create endowments down the road that will help solve some of the problems at some of the black schools. But I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to put that program together right now, but you can speak on any topic concerning the National Business League that you like. And just let me mention this, We do have a global audience, and we do archive these programs, and we do actually promote the fact that we archive these programs so that people can go back even, you know, weeks, months, or perhaps years later to learn what we discussed. So whatever you say this evening about the program's topic of the National Business League, I'm certainly going to make sure that the word gets out that they can get access to anything that you have announced or that you have taught us. So I just want to mention that. But let me go ahead and welcome two others. Well, one dropped just a second ago, but I want to welcome my dearly beloved sister-in-law who just joined us, and I'll let her announce herself if she wants to do that. How are you doing, sister-in-law?
I am fine, thank you. Happy holidays, everyone.
Hey.
Happy holidays. Did you want to tell
Happy Kwanzaa.
Yeah, happy Kwanzaa as well. Thanks, Dr. Harris. Did you want to tell you want me to keep it anonymous? That's up to you.
No, I didn't understand what you said.
Well, do you want to announce your name or do you want me to let it remain anonymous? That's up to you.
No, I don't have to be anonymous. Hi, everyone. I am Stephanie Runnels, and I'm glad to be a part of this family forum.
Okay. I don't. Did you get the information about the topic for tonight?
No, I would like if you would reiterate what the topic
okay,
is
about. Okay, let me reiterate a topic for tonight. The topic is this. Why did Howard University Medical School terminate the employment? And in essence, it wasn't called a termination of employment. It was called a denial of tenure, which in all practical reality is the same thing, of Assistant Professor Dr. Francis Kress Wesley. This was in 1975, after she published her racial theories of white alienation and color confrontation, and just briefly, and I hope Ms. Becky and Dr. I guess if you'll bear with me, I just want to share this information with Stephanie, so to bring her up to date on the situation. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Wesley, but she was a very prominent psychiatrist. Child psychologist specifically, who did a residency and was hired as a professor of pediatrics at Howard University Medical School. And she had worked there 7 years, and so she was at the point of having her tenure application reviewed. And when it was reviewed, she was denied after spending many, many years doing great work there at Howard as a professor. The committee on promotions and tenure recommended her highly. But the dean of the medical school, they repudiated their recommendation, denied her application for tenure, and the president backed him up. And so she had to go elsewhere for employment after having been settled there at Howard. From where she graduated, so she'd been there for 10 years as a medical student and then as a professor. But now she had to go somewhere else, and she went to the government and got a job working with the Department of Human Services, and later went into private practice. But the fact is that she was a young woman in her early 30s with a career in front of her, but just because she took a stand concerning what she saw was a problem between black and white, which is that the white people feared genetic annihilation because they weren't reproducing as much as the black people were, and they were taking every means possible to try to even encourage black people to get sterilized. Just a minute. So these things ended up with her being basically, I hate to use this street word, but basically kicked out of Howard. And so we were talking about, you know, why do you think that they did that to her? That's basically the bottom line. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, would you like your response?
Just like nowadays, they don't want to teach Black history. It's an embarrassment to those oppressors. It makes them look like devils. And teaching Black history, if you teach all of Black history and the real Black history, it looks real bad. They're too ashamed to have that as a teaching. And they need to remember half of the Black history is of good things, innovative things, inventions and powerful things of great people. And then the other half is about a people who was so devilish and oppressing another race. You know, so she probably spoke up on some things and that they just couldn't handle. It wasn't right for them to fire her because of speaking the truth, but this has become a real problem. It's like they're trying to erase Black history. They don't want to remember it. It's hard for us to have to remember those things and still be civil as a people. But it's, they're trying to take it out of the school still right now. You know, I think that's really unfortunate. But we have to continue on teaching. It's important, and a lot of things that I didn't learn in Black history, I learned from my own grandmother, who's from Mississippi. She used to tell me all the stories. You know, even when the movie Roots came out, there was nothing in that movie that shocked me because I had already read so much, you know. It's really unfortunate because this is our homeland, has been for hundreds of years, and it's being made hush hush. You can say this part, but not that part. So if you're just telling white history, you're definitely not telling the whole history. And even in telling the white history, there's so much that's so embarrassing for them. They choose to leave that out, too. So I believe that's the reason they got rid of her. They didn't want to be too exposed to the public. And it does make them look bad, but it is what it is. Thank you.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you. We've got about 15 minutes before we'll wrap up, and I do want to give Dr. Kenneth Harris, the National CEO and President of the National Business League, a few minutes if you would like to take advantage of the time, Dr. Harris, to the Business League. As I say, the program is archived, and so those who are not listening via the Internet or calling in tonight will still have access to this information because we will promote this particular archive very aggressively, so that whatever you say that you would like for our audience and our potential audience to hear will be available to them. So let me turn it over to you, and you can speak any way you would like to about the National Business League.
Oh, no, thank you so much, Brother Cavanaugh, for having me on the show and amongst your guests and supreme topic of one of not only notable scholars, but Dr. Francis Cress Wellesley, who pushed the envelope and challenged a way for us all to think in a time where subjectivity towards the freedom of thought was controlled, or either, as our your sister-in-law mentioned, controlled and suppressed. And so, you know, with that being said, in the lights of my position and role, I recently the national president of the National Business League, of which your great grandfather founded in 1900. and reminiscent of his message 118 years later. His message is more relevant today than it was 118 years ago. And so to be able to help rejuvenate this organization and bring it back to its original prominence is both an honor and a humbling experience, when at the same time, I think relative to the discussion that you are having today, we need to get back to institutionalizing our agenda as black people, and which your great-grandfather was able to do was the National Negro Business League to do that in terms of an economic platform. And so what we've done recently is revamped the board of directors and relaunched our regions in both Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, and recently moved the headquarters from Washington, D.C., where it had been since 1956, to Detroit, Michigan. We kept our incorporation in Washington as to where that is, will be our political advocacy influence for that particular region. And so we also are in the process of our MBL 2020 campaign, which is going to allow us to engage the more than 2.9 million black-owned businesses that exist across the country and within our 365 leagues that are still in operation today. And so with that, it is really important for us to help transition our train of thought to an economic platform, which I truly believe is the third reconstruction. The first reconstruction was post-slavery, where they promised us 40 acres and a mule, but we know we got a half-legged mule and the acres they took back. They also gave us the Freedmen's Bank, where we could deposit our monies and learn how to trust the banking system. Actually, the bank ended up closing as much as Frederick Douglass tried to save it at the last second. But our trust in financial institutions have been a relative historic depiction of where we are today and how we operate finances. And that second reconstruction I always talk about is either civil no rights, because it did not have an economic agenda attached to it, or what Nixon called a fraction of the action, which they taught us how to get a piece of the pie as opposed to aiming for the whole pie, or what's in place now, affirmative half action, and in which every other minority group or perceived minority group or created minority group, which is some of which are truly not disenfranchised or economically depressed or suppressed in any way, are benefiting off the backs of black folks who obviously opened the doors for so many. And so what I believe is the third reconstruction is the financial and economic independence of black people, which is reminiscent of the platform that great-grandfather created so many years ago. And if it's up to us, if you go to a classroom today, Brother Cavanaugh, and you ask a classroom of students, black students in particular, would they rather work for someone else or would they rather own their own business, I would probably say the majority of the time, 90% of those students are going to raise their hand and they would love to own their own business. And probably the other 10% would probably say, hey, I want to be a licensed professional, but I would still like to have an entrepreneurial mind behind that. And so, you know, if we look back at history, we know every time we have always been entrepreneurial, even since the foundings of civilization, in which we created the arts, the math, the sciences. We were master general contractors and engineers. We built all types of societies, civilizations, going back to Kemet, the Nile Valley, the beginning of time. And so now we're just now reclaiming that history to know that we are an entrepreneurial community. And even post-slavery, Brother Cavanaugh, we tried our best to enter the economic mainstream. And every time black people try to enter the economic mainstream of society, all types of barriers were either put in place. Jim Crow segregation laws were put into place, or even communities like Black Wall Street in Durham and Oklahoma, Tulsa, et cetera, were burnt to the ground. You know, so now I think reminiscent of our goals and objectives to be entrepreneurial, just like other immigrant populations or like your sister-in-law says, we are the indigenous people of this land and every other land, going back to Africa, that we reclaim our abilities to own our own or continue to be owned by someone else. And so why not have this organization in which I see being the actual voice for entrepreneurial and economic development, not just here in the United States, but across the entire globe. So people can, as of January 1st of this year, go to www.nationalbusinessleague.org, and they can either join a local league or they can become a part of this renaissance and movement that we will build on top of the shoulders of the late, great, iconic, legendary Booker T. Washington, who will be proud to know that we're going to push the envelope and add a little Amaral to some of these old tires out here and add a little technology to it.
Right on.
Well, thank you so very much. We're reaching the last part of the show, so we want to give everyone that would like to make just those comments a chance to do it before we do wrap up. And there's something I want to add before we wrap up, so we'll go back to the top and ask Santa, would you like to comment on what Dr. Harris just said or what Sister Stephanie said or what I said?
Well, you know, you get back to those historical black colleges and universities, you only have five that have a graduation rate above 50% in 6 years. And on top of that, blacks are overrepresented in low-paying majors. And that in itself affects your endowment, because it's students who go on into professions and careers and earn money that gives back to those institutions that they come from to create that endowment. That has to change. Nobody's going to change that, because we're talking about creating people that's going to be competitive. Nigerians are not going to teach African-American kids how to take power away from their kids, those that's born here in the United States even. That's something that has to change. You look at the institution where these kids are coming from before they hit the college doors. They aren't prepared. It's not the child's fault. Being the fact that nobody else is going to put the effort to create competition for their kids, the fault has to lie with black society itself. And when you look at the obstacles that come out of black society to solutionable methods like school choice with vouchers at the elementary level, where parents can put their child in the environment that they feel is best for their child's long-term educational goals. Because from what I've witnessed, a lot of black children that's in some of these institutions don't belong there, because they are much ahead of the rest of the class. And being held there, they become bored and disgruntled. When you look at the state of California, according to one report, 75% of black males aren't reading at level. 75% are not reading at level. I visited a school, and I think I told you about it, or maybe a month ago or so, and the principal told me that only 10% of her third grade class is reading at level. they need tutors, volunteers to come in at one institution, which is not solely by itself. There's many like that. You need people to go in and work with these kids. But you can't get anybody out of the black community to come in to any great extent. And at one school, they had a chemical company where whites volunteered to go in and help the kids with reading. And of course, they brought in pre-packaged reading material like Old Yellow, Huckleberry Finn, and The Legends of Sleepy Hollow. Well, that's what they wanted to bring. They're not going to bring in material that's on an African-centered perspective where you, every other sentence, every other paragraph is down in whites. They're not going to work with that. Be realistic. So if you want your children to learn, I'm not saying you, but if there's a need for African-American kids to learn how to read and be assisted by tutors, well, either it's going to have to come out of their society or others is going to feel a need and a sympathy, but they're going to come with what's comfortable for them. That's just the way it works. So I don't know what further more I can say. And a lot of these, I think you're down to about, 115 historical black colleges and universities. I was listening to someone speaking on the topic that was closer to it than I am, for sure, to those organizations. And they made the mention that by the near future, you're going to be down to like 25. Because some of those schools, Marshall, have a graduation rate of 17% or even less in 6 years. That's totally ridiculous. That is totally ridiculous. So I guess that's about all I can comment on that.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. I'm just going to go ahead. And Stephanie, would you like to add something? We're going to close in a few minutes. We want to give everyone a chance, and then we're going to ask Dr. Harris to actually give us the last word, as you might say. But before he does, I do have something brief that I want to share. But Stephanie, would you like to comment now?
Yes, I would. Well, first of all, while it's on my mind, thank you, Dr. Harris. I appreciated everything you said. It was really knowledgeable. Those things are really needed in our society, and it gives a person hope. I think it's great, the things that you're working on. I appreciate it. Second of all, I would like to say, Dr. Bianca, I am a person who has done lots of volunteer work in schools as a reading tutor, and I am a black female, and I was not alone in that. The last thing I would like to say, let's not forget the statistics. The highest graduating classes in colleges are black females nowadays, African American at that. And I'm just real proud of a lot of these youngsters. They are pilots and doctors and administrators and engineers, and they're just in every walk of life. Thank God, still they rise. So I give them two thumbs up. I don't see the glasses half empty. I see it as half full. And thank you, my brother-in-law. Great show.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. And Sister Maina has joined us. I saw her come online about a half an hour ago and left, but I'm glad you're back, Sister Maina. And I don't know if you are familiar with the topic. You can let me know if you want me to reiterate. But we're welcome to go and you heard some of the conversation. Or would you like to go ahead and have me reiterate?
I'm driving. I was driving before, and I'm still driving. So I don't even know what you were talking about. So I'm driving.
Okay. Well, that's fine. If you have something
all
on your mind, Would you like to contribute anything that's on your mind? Okay, well, I don't really believe you should be distracted while you're driving. I don't want to be enabling you to do something that's probably not safe. So why don't you go ahead, and we'll look forward to you contributing next time when you're in another situation.
I really hate that I missed this session.
Well, that's okay. We're going to be talking, as we do every week. This is the African-American Weekly Family Room Forum, and we know that you join us regularly. So whatever comes up in the next few days that you want to talk about, you can send me a text, and we'll make it the topic for next Saturday.
All right. I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to by sharing something that's relevant that is, I think will corroborate a lot of things we've talked about, especially in view of the topic being around education. This is actually an extract that I'm going to share with you from a book which was published in 1965 during the height of the civil rights movement, and at the kickoff of the Black Power movement. And it's entitled "Message to the Black Man in America," and it's written by the late honorable Elijah Muhammad. And the title of this article is "Get Knowledge to Benefit Self." And I'm not going to read every line, but I want to pick out a few what I can. Said to be strategically important things. He says, Mr. Muhammad says, I am for the acquiring of knowledge or the accumulating of knowledge, as we now call it, education. But first, my people must be taught the knowledge of self. Then and only then will they be able to understand others and that which surrounds them. And I think that's one of the things that Dr. Francis Cress Wesleyan was promoting, and also I heard a brief talk today on YouTube from Dr. Omar Johnson, and he's been very, very big on that same issue of promoting the knowledge of self. And so I'm skipping a few things here, but Mr. Muhammad says that my people should get an education which will benefit their own people, and not an education adding to the storehouse of their teacher. We need education, but an education which removes from us because of slavery and servitude. Again, an education, but not an education which leaves us in an inferior position and leaves us looking to the slave master for a job. He's still calling the former slave master the slave master. Now, I don't believe, to be frank with you, because I was a part of his movement when he was alive, that he was trying to discredit our preparing to become accepted into the larger domain of work. And I'll tell you the reason why, because I got a job with a very prestigious financial services company back around 1971 was a big year for me, because I was interviewed by one of the big financial companies, and I was told by the manager that hired me that they had interviewed 75 other candidates, and they felt that I was the best fit. And one of the things that impressed them was that I read a checkoff list of characteristics that the Abdullah Muhammad said that we should have in order to be able to become hired in corporate America. So he was not discouraging us in that regard, but at the same time, he was telling us that we needed to have the industries that would allow us to be entrepreneurs and industrialists, in addition to being able to get jobs in other people's industries. But let me go ahead and cut to the chase. But he says here, that we should get an education which will make our people produce jobs for self and will make our people willing and able to go for self. And then as I wrap this up, I'll just mention, he says, is this not the goal and aim of the many foreign students who are studying in this country? Will not these students return to their own nations and give their people the benefit of their learning? And then he mentions some people that were living back in the 60s when he wrote this book that are not living now, but they were leaders of countries in Africa who came to America and earned degrees. Several of them earned doctorate degrees in prestigious American schools and went back to their countries to help build up the economy in their own country. So finally, I'll just say this, and I'm not going to quote from the book any further. I truly believe that there's a place on both sides of the equation, a very, very viable place. Persons like Dr. Harris, who is encouraging not only that that our college graduates and our technical school graduates and others to qualify for jobs in the Fortune 500 companies, as well as becoming entrepreneurs. And, you know, I found out when I was in the business world that many of these Fortune 500 companies depend on small businesses for inputs or products that will be assembled or that they will actually sell that these smaller businesses are actually producing. So there's room for entrepreneurs starting off with businesses of 20 to 50 people and maybe eventually having 300 employees and still being able to be part of that corporate mainstream as suppliers. So it's not an either-or proposition, but we definitely need to be thinking of putting it into the minds of our college students, our tech school students, and our high school students to do what Dr. Harris is doing a remarkably great job and has been for some time in terms of trying to uplift the consciousness of our people in general to become business people. And so with having said that, I'm going to turn over to you, Dr. Harris, for the wrap-up, if you'd like to take time, as much time as you want to take, to give us some closing comments.
Yeah, one again, thank you, Marshall. The humbling experience of being able to contribute to dialogue amongst the good doctor who spoke earlier. I haven't had a chance to engage him in a way personally, but it was great hearing his remarks. And your sister-in-law, whose spirit just transcends across the entire phone with her a direct ability to connect the dots effectively. But we have to really be honest with ourselves as we go forward. In 25 years, the United States of America will be majority, and I hate the word minority, but we will be a majority indigenous of people of color who will represent the consumer base, who will represent the voting population, who will represent a large percentage of the overall gross domestic product, the GDP, and contribute greatly, as we do today, as a community of more than $1.5 trillion to the overall economy. Imagine 25 years from now what that looks like. And so we have been programmed to think in arenas where we only have access to. When you look at statistics in different industries and sectors, we are largely misrepresented or not represented at all. And I think the good doctor mentioned as well, we're going into industries that are not creating generational wealth opportunities. And even in corporate America, where we are seeing out of our, and your sister-in-law is right, we have a profound achievement amongst African-American women who are graduating as the highest percentage of educated people in the country, more so than any race, gender, or creed. And so when you think about that and what the black woman has been able to do, And even in comparison to that, black men are graduating at extraordinary rates, but that is not promoted. And so with that, us being able to take that education in whatever form, whether it's inside of a HBCU or PWI or off in the streets, entrepreneurship crosses all of those planes. And it goes back to Booker T. Washington, your great-grandfather, who said, cast your bucket down where you are. And we have to get back to the basics of those who have the opportunity to become the best in their chosen endeavor, to give back to these communities, and to educate in a way to where we can provide for our families a meaningful life, and more importantly, an economic stable situation that leads to generational wealth. And I believe that is through entrepreneurship and small business ownership. Although we do have expert licensed professionals, you can still have a career and be entrepreneurship minded. And you are also finding out a lot of these individuals who have worked for these Fortune 100, Fortune 50, Fortune 5 companies are leaving those companies to take their expertise and form their own businesses when they find out that they can have access to capital and other resources that might exist. So what I would say in closing is that we have not reached our maximum potential, but we will return back to our original prominence in the world as the founders of civilization. And when we realize, as you mentioned in those quotes, who we are, it's just a matter of time. And so with that, happy holidays, everyone. Happy Kwanzaa. It's beautiful to be black.
Thank you so much, Dr. Harrison. I do want to say this. I said I was going to give you the last one, but I noticed we did have a caller from what appears to be a VOIP, meaning that they're using the internet telephone technology to call in, and I didn't call on before because I usually look for the ones that identify themselves with a phone number, but I don't want to miss anybody. So I call her that's called in. If you call in from a internet technology, would you like to say something before we wrap up? Because we will close after you speak.
I would like to say that this program was very informative and important, and I really enjoyed all the aspects and information from all around.
Okay, did you want to go ahead and add some more, or did you say what you really wanted to say? Okay, she dropped off, but we thank her for coming on and giving us that accolade. We appreciate that all of our internet listeners know that you can actually go up on the in about another 15 to 20 minutes. If you missed part of the program, just go to Blog Talk Radio, Booker T. Washington Speaks. Just do a Google search for Blog Talk Radio, Booker T. Washington Speaks, and you'll see the link to be able to go into the archives of Blog Talk Radio and not only hear tonight's show, but any of the shows that we've done over the past 2 years. And we've covered some very good topics, provocative topics, everything from HBCU's survival to the police killings and sports players and people in the sports world taking the knee addressing the issue of drug prescription to school kids. We've done so much, and we've had so many people from all walks of life, from all over the country, that have given their input. So you can listen to these archives. Just go to Blog Talk Radio, Booker T. Washington Speaks. We want to thank the panelists who are on tonight. We want to give a special kudos to Dr. Ken Harris for the work that he's doing as the CEO, president of the National Business League. We want to thank Ms. Bianchi, our regular panelist, going back to the inception of this program. For those of you that don't know much about him, but he's an international entrepreneur in the engineering domain, having built some very significant structures in not only the United States, but overseas as well. And so we're going to hear more from him. Yes, sir. Did I hear someone wanted to say something? Okay, well, we're going to go ahead. We always like to end with this inspiring song, the Black National Anthem. It's called Lift Every Voice and Sing. Thank you.